Whatever your funny, Peacock's got it exclusively. Stream classic sitcoms like The Office, Parks and Recreation, and 2 and a Half Men. Plus, catch Peacock original comedies like AP Bio and Saved by the Bell. For all your exclusive comedy faves, go to PeacockTV.com and get started.
Love is love is the rallying cry of the modern LGBTQ plus movement, declaring that love is universal among everyone. But in the past, the love that dared not speak its name found other ways to express itself through photography. Photography allowed loving couples to document their relationship, even if they had to hide the pictures away in drawers or books for fear of being discovered.
Thankfully, photograph collectors and real-life married couple Hugh Nini and Neil Treadwell have uncovered thousands of intimate photos of same-sex couples, many of which are featured in their new book, Loving, A Photographic History of Men in Love, 1850s to 1950s. Today, Hugh Nini and Neil Treadwell join us to take a look at these marvelous photographs from their book, Loving, and untangle the secret codes men had for expressing love and intimacy.
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And can you keep a secret?
Yes.
This is Feast of Fun. It's no secret that Feast of Fun is made possible because of fierce, fabulous people just like you.
Become a Plus member at feastoffun.com/plus because your contribution to the show is what makes the show happen.
Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever fine podcasts are found, because love means sharing the things you care about with the world.
Hello.
Hi, this is...
Making a great chicken sandwich should be simple. Just make it crispy, juicy, and tender. Sounds easy, right? McDonald's has perfected the recipe with 3 new crispy chicken sandwiches. Try one for yourself and pair it with a free drink and fries. Now buy any new crispy chicken sandwich, get a free medium fries and medium soft drink or a sweet tea only with mobile order and pay on the McDonald's app. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. Offer valid through April 18th at participating McDonald's. Valid once a day. McD app download and registration required.
It's Fausto.
And Mark from Feast of Fun.
How are you guys doing?
We're doing great, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. We're really enjoying your book, Loving. It should be called The Look of Love because there's so much intense gazes in these men's eyes.
Well, and that was our collecting parameter.
So that's Hugh, and this is Neil.
So which one of you guys is the dancer?
That's me, Hugh.
Hugh. But Hugh, you're also a dance teacher, or somebody just got home from teaching at school?
Yeah, I'm on the faculty at Joffrey Ballet here in New York, but they're semi-closed down, so I'm not teaching there at the moment. I'm doing private coaching one-on-one 5 days a week.
And Hugh is the dance teacher, right?
Yeah, but I've been teaching for 45 years.
Oh, wow.
Now, Hugh, do you teach like with a stick and you like Debbie Allen in the TV show Fame? You go to these dancers, you say, you want fame? Well, fame costs. And here at the Joffrey is where you pay with sweat.
Well, you do pay with sweat, but I don't carry a stick. I speak softly.
Oh.
And yeah, training a dancer is a very complicated process, and it takes, 8 to 10 years, and it starts at A and it ends in, quadruple Z. It's not the way it's portrayed on TV at all.
Yeah, you have to sort of break in your ballet shoes, you have to get your dance belt nice and tight and get your pack of cigarettes for your break.
You would be the worst dance teacher in the world.
Or the greatest. I heard Bob Fosse was relentless.
Well, maybe it's more like the movie Suspiria and that dance class.
Oh, my goodness. Don't want that. Did you see that movie? Did you guys see that movie?
What was the movie? The
Suspiria.
Name again? I didn't see that. No.
Oh, you should definitely check out the original one, horror film from the 60s. It takes place in a dance studio. And then they recently remade it with Dakota Johnson
funny.
And it was a very a testament on women in entertainment, I think.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay, I'll check that out.
Yeah, please do.
Suspiria is a horror film, but the real horror is the physical demands that ballet dancers go through. The ballet dancers we've spoken to really sound a lot like boxers, where their bodies are always being under attack.
Yes.
It physically impacts and not just how you move, but also how you think about your body as well.
Ballet training is learning how to think about your body and how to train muscles to do things that they were not born to do. It's a physical activity, you know, like any sports activity. A ballet dancer in training is more like, it's more analogous to an athlete in training for the Olympics than anything else. Mm.
And that's why I think it's so interesting you guys put together this book of photos of men in intimate poses. You know, they're putting their hands on each other, they're resting their heads in a very subtle way that, you know, someone who's familiar with the language of movement would pick up on.
Well, the intimate embraces and the complicated embraces that you're talking about didn't start to reveal themselves until well into the collection. Our initial, and you said it at the very beginning of this conversation, it was the look. When two people are in love with each other, that's not a look that you can manufacture, and you can't hide it if you're feeling it. And so it shows up in these photographs. And that was initially what drew us to the first photograph, which we had no anticipation there would ever be a second one. And we bought that photograph. It was cheap. I think we paid $5 for a handful of them, and the others were unremarkable. It was just this one of the two men in an embrace. And we took it home and didn't have any plans for it, didn't anticipate that there would ever be a second one, and certainly didn't anticipate that there would ever be enough for a book, much less enough for about 5 or 6 books.
You know, you start collecting mannequins or tiaras or Pez dispensers.
Barbies.
And all of a sudden it's like, who's the person who wanted to start the collection? Was it Neil or Hugh, the dance teacher?
Well, it really, as you said, it wasn't that we were even thinking about starting collection. We just found this first photograph, and so it's laid on the desk. It wasn't until we got into about maybe 300 to 500 photos that we're like, oh my gosh, because I travel a lot. Yeah. For my job. And so I was looking at the photos thinking one thing, and Hugh's teaching ballet and coming home and he's thinking another. And then we get together and we're like, oh my gosh, look at all these photographs we have. We've actually started collecting something here. And, you know, we were both doing it together, but we just didn't realize how many we had until we got to like 500.
And so your friends got together and had an intervention.
We never these photos to anyone for the we didn't think anyone would be interested. Right. We didn't share it with them. We just, you know, we did it. It was something that we enjoyed doing together.
We never had a conversation between the two of us. Neil and I have lots of friends, very good friends, close friends, and lots of them. And we're close to our families as well. But for the first 13 years we were doing this, nobody knew that we were collecting the photographs. So obviously, we didn't see the collection because we weren't sharing it with anybody. We were borderline embarrassed to admit what we were doing, and we didn't have a conversation about doing it or not doing it. We just didn't ever do it. And so nobody knew that we were doing this until 13 years into it. And then the first time we revealed it to anybody, it was to a stranger, someone that we were buying a photograph from. And you know, we were wrong, fortunately, about that. Apparently, people are interested in this collection, and we're very, you know, grateful for it.
Why did you feel embarrassed about it?
We thought they'd think we were weird or something.
I mean, you know,
that's already been decided.
Weirder.
So you just thought that people would think it was unusual that you were like collecting vintage photos of men and romantic embraces and kissing.
Well, it never occurred to us that anyone would be interested. When we looked at them, we were thinking, you know, we're nothing new. We thought we were, I guess, in a way. But seeing these photographs, you know, the love between two men has been around forever. And it was captured in some beautiful images. And it, you know, it spoke to us. So we collected them.
But to answer further your question about why we didn't, we didn't ever even think about doing it. It wasn't that we,
it was an accident. It was something that just evolved on its own.
Evolved on its own. And also I throw this in. Neil and I were extremely busy in our professions, extremely busy. So it's like when we get together with anybody, family or friends, the last thing we were thinking about, although I confess this and I thought about this last night, we would get together on occasion with friends for dinner and there'd be a photo that would be up for auction. We would have the phone under the table and one of us would be watching it and not admit to the people that we were close friends with that we were getting ready to bid on this photo that was up for auction. And that happened on numerous occasions. Yeah. That's how much we hid this, because we it was embarrassing, I think. Kind of for some reason. I don't know why.
We have a copy of the book here in person, and the book is available for purchase through the links on the show notes or through our website, feastoffun.com. And if you get the book, and we're also, with your permission, we're going to be adding some of the album art, changing it to make it a dynamic podcast so you can follow along and you can see some of these images. So we'll be also referring them to them by the page number, if that's okay with you guys. Do you have the copy of the book there?
Sure, we do, yes.
Yeah. What was the first image that started the magnificent obsession?
Well, actually, it's not in the book. You it's would not. Think it would be in okay. there. But, you know, it was a photo of two guys, and one's embracing the other one from behind, his head's on his shoulder. But it was just a very romantic, sweet photograph. They're in front of a house. And it doesn't have the clarity that was needed to be blown up to actually be in the book.
Mm-hmm. And it's also a little bit dark. It was a little bit too dark.
So, but if it was the mystery, because I always tell people, like, sometimes when you're looking to romantically connect with somebody on the internet or a dating app or hookup app, sometimes the less you show allows them to fill in the blanks and imagine more to the story, more to the person than it's actually there. You know, because photography, I see photography as a creative expression, just like painting. And it's as important as what you show as much as what you don't show, right?
Yeah, I guess. But to your point, Neil and I have been together for almost 30 years, so that predates the internet and all this other stuff that you were just talking about.
But photography is universal, and you know, humanity's needed to understand themselves by looking at themselves since the dawn of time.
Yes. Yeah. And so the uniqueness of this collection is simply that these couples wanted to memorialize their love for each other and their relationship in a photograph. And then the next thing they had to do to make sure of its survival is to hide it and keep it hidden for their entire lifetime. And we don't know what happened to them after that, before they came into our hands. But it certainly, they could have never imagined a world where the photograph that they took and kept hidden out of necessity would end up in a book that's being celebrated and admired and loved all over the world, and in the company of, in this case, 327 other photographs of other couples that did the same thing that they did. It's astonishing to think of the societal evolution that's taken place. Okay, go back to 1850s is when our collection starts. Mm-hmm. 1950s is when it ends. So everything that happened between, you know, from the 1950s forward, for this book to exist. These photos have been around for 170 years. This book is just now making, these photos are just now making their debut in 2020. October of 2020 is when we launched. So the book has just barely been out 4 months. Sure.
Do you guys have radiator heat there? I'm hearing this really loud hiss.
Unfortunately, we have the old boiler system.
Oh, you're in New York or in Dallas?
Yeah, we're in New York.
We're in New York now.
And how exciting. What part of New York are you guys living in?
Upper West Side.
And have you guys been tempted to sort of like photograph yourselves and recreate and insert? Maybe you guys are in the book and we just don't know?
No. Well, you know, it's kind of funny because when we were producing the book and they said, oh, you need a headshot. Well, it happened about the time that the COVID hit. So we weren't able to get a headshot. And so there is no good photo of us. We used to take photos when we were just together and young, and people always, you know, say, you know, anyway, it's a long story. But there's no photo in this book of us.
Would it be possible for you guys to move to another area that's a little quieter?
You know, it's going to liberate us from the room with the boiler running for loud.
Are you moving?
Yeah, yes. It sounds like you're like steaming.
You're sitting next to a dragon.
Well, you're like steaming some delicious, you know, New England mussels.
So of the 30 that we had, only two were clear enough or not double exposed or whatever to use in the book. The photos that got chosen for the book had to have, number one, they had to be loving, they had to have a strong message, and they had to have enough clarity that they could be blown up on large format like the page of a book. Mm. And those were the only two that qualified for that.
Well, that's the thing about, you know, when we talk about gay histories, the history of same-sex relationships, we've seen, especially, you know, in important historical figures, that the intimate relationships what they had with members of their same gender either be dismissed as deep, intimate friendships, the way the musical Hamilton sort of erase Alexander Hamilton's relationship with Lawrence, or the way sort of, historians explain away George Washington Carver's very effeminate, high-pitched voice.
Or and, like Abraham Lincoln sleeping in the same bed right. with Joshua Speed for years, right?
Yes. And, and also George Washington Carver had a relationship where he shared a bed with another man for many of the last years of his life, you know. And so in looking at these photos, you can sort of, somebody who's going to be a little bit more skeptical or cynical is going to dismiss them as these are just two close friends. In fact, that was a coded language for lesbians back in the 1950s. It's just good friends. Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, like if somebody was gay, they said they had shiny shoes. When women were lesbians, they were like just good friends. Mm-hmm. And so that gets blown away. That gets thrown out of the window because you guys have a photo here in page 90 at the mm-hmm. sort of the beginning of the book that says not married, but willing to be.
That's astonishing, isn't it?
Mm.
Who are these guys?
So we have five photographs of them. Mm-hmm. They're also on the opposite. There's another one of them on the opposite page, mm-hmm. holding an umbrella together with their fingers entwined. And that sign, not married but willing to be, is a ordinary prop that would be in a lot of photographers' studios during that time. They would also have funny hats and, you know, tools and pencils and paintbrushes and stuff like that, so you could pose with all these things. And so what that sign was for is for a single man who would be, you know, he'd be shaved, get his hair cut, wear his best suit, go in and have his picture taken in a couple different poses and a couple different ways. And one of them would be him holding the signs saying, hey, ladies, I'm not married, but I'm willing to be. And so this couple turned this around and gave it a completely different meaning 120 years ago and held the sign together saying, we're not married to each other, but we're willing to be. Aww. They're young. The self-awareness to have done something like that during, you know, that long ago, it's just it's breathtaking.
Actually. Now you mentioned the accompanying photo that they're using an umbrella, and you say yes. that the umbrella in old photographs is actually code for yes. we're a couple.
Yes.
So like we see that in image 314 is a same-sex couple getting married underneath an umbrella in a sunny day, you know.
Yes, right. The first umbrella photo that we got was, again, we collected it because of the look in the couple's eyes. And then, you know, we got more photos with the same look. And then we got another photo of a couple with an umbrella, same look. And it wasn't until we got into about fourth or fifth umbrella photo that we started thinking, is this a theme? And now we're up to about 40 or 50, I believe. So starting in the late 1850s, going up to the end of the 1920s and not any time past that, that umbrella was a signal that this is a couple.
Because they're sheltering together. Yeah.
Is that why Trump didn't want to share his umbrella with his wife?
I think maybe she didn't want to share with him. But either way, they're two awful people. They should have been under separate umbrellas under any circumstances.
Now, in turn of the century England and here in the United States, like in England, gay men used to wear green carnations. Mm-hmm. Gay men here in Chicago to symbolize you were gay and if you were ready to meet somebody out on the streets, because we had a huge, you know, influx of immigrants and population here. Men wore red ties to symbolize that they were gay. This has been covered in the Chicago History Museum and books and stuff. Are you finding other items like that are queer coded in the book?
Well, it's interesting in a lot of the photographs, and we saw it starting probably around the 1920s. Well, actually, back in the 1850s as well. It's jewelry, and they have matching jewelry, whether it's matching rings or bracelets. And, you know, it used to be it might be that you wore it on your right hand instead of your left hand. But the fact is that they actually share jewelry, and they look at it. So there's photographs of them holding hands or pointing to the ring that's on the other person's finger. But again, it always goes back to the look of the guys in their eyes in these photographs.
We collected the photograph because of the look they had in their eyes. It wasn't until we started blowing the photographs up and selecting them for the book that we started to see all the jewelry that we had missed the first time around. There's a lot of ring wearing in a lot of these photographs.
Are there any specific photos that you can on a page number refer to so people who have your book can look at?
Sean and John and Daryl, and this is a our essay covers the story. The only couple that we have firsthand information about their relationship is on, Neil will find the page, two World War soldiers who fought in Germany, American soldiers that fought in Germany during World War II.
It's on page 110, and it's two stacked photos.
On page 110, it's two stacked photos. We acquired five photographs from of this couple, and the poses were very ordinary, but we detected something in the look in their eyes. In the five photographs we collected, they were just standing side by side or sitting on a fence together or on a swimming deck or something. And there was just something about it that, you know, we said, this is a couple. And then sometime later, months later, maybe even half a year later, the photo of the two of them posing, embracing in the snow showed up, and they're wearing rings on their wedding ring finger. Now, we know the story of the couple, but mainly of one of the soldiers, because we're in contact with his living nephew, who wears that ring of his uncle's to this day.
No, I wasn't planning on crying during this show.
it's even a little more sad than that. Give you a brief timeline, a 2-week timeline for these two guys. Number one, they belong to the 42nd Infantry Division that fought through Germany. And the name of the division is the Rainbow Division. You cannot make this stuff up.
Wow.
Was that a conscious name?
Whoa. No, it was named after World War II, World War I in 1917. It was named that way because it was comprised of soldiers from all over the United States, not from one particular area. So they said because you come from everywhere, it's a rainbow. So anyway, that's how it got its name. But you know, the irony, you can't escape it. There are many pictures of the two of them standing in front of headquarters with a giant rainbow painted on the headquarters building, and just smiling very proudly in front of this rainbow. Never, you know, a hint that it would eventually mean something completely different. But back to the story.
Yeah.
The Rainbow Division is very famous, and two books have been written about it, because on April 29th, 1945, they were approaching the town of Dachau. And just before they got to the town, someone intercepted them and said, don't go into the town, follow this road in the forest, and there'll be something that you need to take care of. And the Rainbow Division came upon Dachau concentration camp. They were the first ones there. They liberated it. There was fighting, there was gunshots. Some of the inmates overtook the guards and beat them to death, you know, rightfully so. But they came upon unspeakable horrors that they could, you know, nobody knew about. They had just started coming across concentration camps at that point, and not word had gotten around to everybody. John and Daryl were definitely there at the liberation, because John took photographs of the front gate of Dachau concentration camp. And he also took a photograph of this. It's a famous photograph in Holocaust history, of a boxcar full of, you know, emaciated dead men. And he took that photograph himself as well. And those are in the collection. So that's April 29th, 1945. Germany surrenders a week later, and the war in Europe is over. And sometime shortly after that, Daryl and John and the rest of the Rainbow Division are stationed in Kitzbühel, Austria. And they hike up into the Alps with a friend, and they pose. There's several photographs of them in the snow, and the one that's in the book is the most romantic one, where they're posing together. and showing their rings that they've given each other. The ring it's worn, like I said today, by his nephew every day. John went home to Texas, was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy, and spent the rest of his life in a wheelchair.
Oh.
Oh, my God. What happened to their relationship?
We don't know. Because all of this took place before the nephew was long before the nephew was born. But what we do know is that John would take out the shoebox where he kept these photographs hidden because he lived with his mother. She was his caretaker. And he was not, he was only out to the nephew who lived next door to him, his sister's son. And he would take the shoebox out and he would, you know, look at the photographs of him and Daryl together and remember their relationship, and he never talked about it to his nephew per se, but his nephew retells that even when he was a kid, he saw his uncle, you know, reminiscing with the photographs. So one can only imagine.
You know, in films, when we see portrayals of gay relationships, like in Call Me by Your Name or Brokeback Mountain, they usually get criticized by the fact that these relationships kind of don't ever have a happy ending, and a happy ending meaning like, you know, miserable in marriage.
Happily married.
Happily married. You know, the love is very intense, and part of its intensity is that it exists almost outside of time, you know, the way these photos capture that. And hearing that story, I'm wondering, like, what your thoughts are on the way that gay relationships have been portrayed in comparison to your own relationship, where you guys got legally married in 1992, and you're very much deeply in love, obviously, and still living and working together.
Well, the period that you're talking about, Brokeback Mountain and Call Me By Your Name, happened in the 50s and up into the 70s. And so, you know, I think there's a different viewpoint still in this, all the way up to the 70s, especially as I grew up on a ranch, of quote cowboys being together. So, you know, being in rodeo and everything else, which I also did, that's, you know, there back in the 70s or in early 60s, there weren't any open cowboys that I knew of.
Tell me more, Neil.
So, you know, I'm moving forward to us getting married and everything. I mean, luckily, by the time we did get married, both sides of the family were very supportive of us, and which, you know, we're very fortunate for that.
And Vito Russo, are you familiar with his book?
Oh, yeah, Celluloid Closet, yeah.
Yes, I was fortunate to be able to thank him personally for that book, and he autographed it for me. It is essential reading for anybody, and better than anybody explains, and this is one of the reasons we think this book is so important. These men loved each other. They mattered to one another. They took the risk of taking a photograph to memorialize that, and then they kept it hidden so that it would survive. And all the while they're doing all of this, their lives are being narrated by politicians and religious leaders, and not in a very kind way. And they can't say anything about it. And this is, you know, this is for all of time, up until the 1960s, maybe just a little bit. We started to talk, no, let us tell you about our lives. You stop telling us what you think they are. And so, you know, movies coming out of Hollywood did a horrible job of portraying gay people and what their lives were really like. This book sets the record straight. No pun intended, sorry.
Clarifies the story.
Clarifies it. These men, for the first time in history, are getting to narrate their own lives. They're getting to say, you can ignore all of that noise from back then. This is what it was really like. We loved each other. We mattered to one another. We cared enough to take a photograph of it.
Yeah, and in photo 66, is two men sitting on a swing, and one of the...
Whatever you're funny, Peacock's got it exclusively. Stream classic sitcoms like The Office, Parks and Recreation, and 2.5 Men. Plus, catch Peacock original comedies like AP Bio and Saved by the Bell. For all your exclusive comedy faves, go to PeacockTV.com and get started. Whatever you're funny, Peacock's got it exclusively. Stream classic sitcoms like The Office, Parks and Recreation, and 2.5 Men. Plus, catch Peacock original comedies like AP Bio and Saved by the Bell. For all your exclusive comedy faves, go to PeacockTV.com and get started.
them has his finger in his mouth. Kind of, which is a very similar pose that I saw in the musical Applause with Lauren Bacall that was filmed for made for television special. When Lauren Bacall meets one of her gay fans at a gay bar in Greenwich Village, he's flabbergasted by her and he puts his finger kind of in his mouth like and so they're kind of the couple here. They're very much sort of
mischievous, having, right?
Yeah, seeing their relationship is almost as an act of rebellion.
Is it photo 66 or page 6? Oh,
page 66. We're going by the pages because
they've got two hats on. They're sitting on a park bench. One
it's a swinging bench with it's a swinging chain.
Bench.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh,
I never noticed the chain.
Thank you. We never
finally some bondage.
It's not just sentimentality. Like you can sort of reach back in time and see the rebelliousness, the anarchy, the humor, the silliness in what these people found themselves in that time period is being very much at odds with their desire for intimacy.
Yes. And on the photo on the opposite page of that, we have a duplicate of that one. And we acquired the first one at some point and the second one about 10 years later. And the second one came from Australia.
Yeah, he's doing the same pose again. Like,
yeah.
Is that like something like I'm in love? It's an old fashioned gesture. And I'll share
with, thinking of you.
I'll share with you guys this story because I spent a summer in East Berlin shortly after the Berlin Wall came down.
Wow.
And it was a rare opportunity to sort of like experience gay men in the area who had sort of been cut off from, you know, they were quickly catching up with the modern gay world. And so a lot of their gestures were like 100 years in the past.
Wow.
And so one thing that was, I saw really common in the bars and museums, you know, where people are cruising each other was that gesture.
Of putting your finger to your mouth.
Putting your finger to your mouth, but also winking, kind of like a Betty Boop cartoon. Like, and somebody did that to me, and I thought, oh, the poor man has something in his eye. Do you need to go to the bathroom and wash it out with some water? And he's like, no, I think, he barely spoke any English, but he was expressing admiration and desire interest in me. And that's the thing about it is like, you know, when we think about how we communicate with each other non-verbally, though, just like language, it changes through time.
Yes, it does. And this pose that you're referring to, what we discovered in looking at this collection is that over across the entire world and over the entire century this collection represents, men, these couples were arriving at some intricate and complicated poses to have their picture taken in. They could have never seen one another's photographs or seen one another, you know, a photograph of somebody else. It's just something somehow they organically arrived at. There's the double hand hold. There's the over the shoulder finger holder. There's just the full frontal arms wrapped around embraces and some others. And we arranged our albums for ourselves here at our home with those themes. And you can have, you know, 4 pages of men posing and embracing in a very complicated and exact way that covers the entire globe and might span, you know, 50, 60, 70 years or something. So there's something about the humanness, the humanity of it, that they just organically arrived at these poses without having seen one another. Everybody's seen the Titanic thing, and I'm the king of the world, where he holds her by the waist and she throws her arms out, and everybody copies that. They weren't copying anything. They were just arriving at these poses by themselves.
Well, this is like when we watch Bugs Bunny cartoons, they're like referencing celebrities, and you're like, I have no idea who this person is. You know, and part of it is like they may have been referencing something they saw in a vaudeville show or in a newspaper or in a painting or in a newsreel.
Yeah.
And they're like, that was the hot thing in their scene at the time. Like these photos of people sitting on the moon on page 70 Mark, you were saying like it's sort of referencing the song Fly Me to the Moon.
Oh, I don't know if it's that, but you've seen that, especially like in the 1920s, a lot of people having their photo taken with the moon, right?
Like the TV show, The Honeymooners.
There's also that Paper Moon, that song Paper Moon. Yeah.
Paper Moon, yeah. Wonderful movie, film, great film. Yeah, that would be at an arcade or a fair or something like that, and couples and singles and so forth would go and sit on the crescent, the half moon, and have their photo taken, and male couples did it as well.
Yeah, even the moon looks gay in this photo.
It's
a three-way.
That's the full page you're talking about, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's four photos of different moons. And I imagine, like, if you know, they're sitting on Coney Island taking their photo, they're like, "Hey, you wise guys, get off the moon. This is for men and women."
Well,
they're like, they're like, "Hey, you know, $5.
Coney Island." They say there's a whole book out there on Coney Island and how gay Coney Island was and how it was a refuge for queers to go and to work there and to hang out. So,
well, you just explained something to us that we've wondered about because
it's so interesting. A lot of the photos on the beach, I mean, there's people behind, and you know, there's guys that are laying there having their picture taken. Their legs are entangled. Mm-hmm. They're holding on to each other in an intimate position that, you know, probably, you know, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, we'd be going, "Well, we can't have our photograph." We wouldn't do that on a beach and have our photograph taken. We'd be scared that someone would, you know, beat us or something. So there was that awareness that, you know, or they didn't care, and or no one else really cared either.
It was part of that culture.
Yeah.
The collection also reveals to us something that's really clear. From the beginning of the 1890s to the end of the 1920s, there was a lot of freedom, a lot of openness, and a lot of acceptance. And there was the expressions on the couple's faces is more outward and joyful. And part of that is, you know, that's the 1890s was a booming time. And so I think that was part of that. But going forward into the 1920s, you just see a greater sense of openness and acceptance and freedom. And then what happens is the Hays Code, the Hollywood Hays Code, steps in and says, if you're going to put a gay person in a movie, they have to either kill themselves or kill somebody else or be miserable. Otherwise, you can't portray them. Mm-hmm. And then that slammed the door on all that.
And then certainly there was the Lavender Scare in the early 50s. And it's interesting you stop your book at that point in time, because that's when a lot of queer culture just went underground at that point in time.
Yes.
Oh, and you know, to sort of explain further the Hays Code, I used to always think of it as like, you know, this like Hollywood cracking down on same-sex affection and relationships and storylines. But what it really was, it was a relationship to the Fatty Arbuckle scandal, where somebody, died in a very scandalous way. And at that time period, it was sort of Hollywood trying to save the industry from getting it shut down in movie theaters around the country. And in much like Bill Clinton's Don't Ask, Don't Tell, it was sort of this concession that very progressive minded people made at the time because they feared even worse things happening.
No, Bill Clinton was threatened with worse things. They said, if you do this with an executive order, we're going to pass the Democrats, led by Sam Nunn out of Georgia, said, we're going to pass a law in the House and we're going to make it illegal.
They were threatening an amendment to the U.S. Constitution to make same-sex marriage and possibly even relationships illegal.
In 92?
In 1992, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Right. Yeah, there was. Well, I was there. You guys were too. You were busy getting married. But yeah, in 1992, I mean, it was a highly controversial topic because, you know, we were at the height of the AIDS crisis and there was no end in sight. And people are like, why are you worrying about marriage equality when we're just fighting to stay alive?
I don't remember marriage. Oh no, that was in Hawaii. Right. Hawaii was about to pass equal marriage. Yeah, right. And so you're right. That was sort of tied up with all of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell and everything. Yeah.
Bill Clinton sort of rewritten as sort of a controversial or conservative figure at the time, and he certainly in interviews says that, you know, he was kind of at odds with what to do about it. And he felt mm-hmm. like that was a mistake. They just didn't know what to do.
It was the least of two evils. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think he gets wrongly blamed for that, because the other alternative was what you just said, is that they were going to pass a law and a constitutional amendment saying you cannot be in the military if you are gay. And so he said, how about we do this instead? And that's how we got it. So he did not fail us. You know, all the Republicans and a big number of Democrats did.
Now, you guys travel the world, have gone different places and buy different collections and stuff like that. Is there like a geographic area that you're just like, wow, this is where all the gay people lived, or where all totally. The gay photographs ended up? Like, where would that be in this world?
Yeah, what are good thrift stores to go to?
Well, you know, when we do travel, we have great friends in Budapest. And when we were over there, you know, all the different countries that are around it, and Bulgaria seems to have the most, has the largest number of photographs we have found of affectionate men coming through us. I mean, we have different.
They are way overrepresented for some reason.
Yeah, way over. I guess because they kept their photos and the family didn't care, and so the family didn't burn them. Mm. But I mean, you know, we have
four collectors that we work with in Bulgaria. We have four in Russia now. But for the non-U.S. photos, Bulgaria by far has the most. Mm.
And in the United States, is there an area where you're just like, God, how did they all congregate here?
There's a reason. Alan Berube wrote a book, and I can't even think of the title now. And he explains that we think of people fleeing to the East Coast and the West Coast, mm-hmm. you know, gay people. And in fact, it's the other way around. At the end of World War II, the U.S. military wanted to cut its costs, and they said, let's give blue discharges to, this means you're fired because you're gay, to all of the gay soldiers that just finished fighting in World War II. They also gave blue discharges to African-American soldiers if they had a blemish on the record. They, ran a red light or something like that. They'd say, okay, now you're also getting a blue discharge. And that means that they don't get any benefits from the Army. They don't get GI Bill. They mm-hmm. don't get the GI Bill. They don't get to go to the VA for treatment or anything like that. So they pull at the end of World War II, they pull the boats into the harbor, and they dumped all these soldiers, gay soldiers, into New York and into the West Coast. And these, you know, what are you going to do? You're from Pocatello, Idaho, and you've got a discharge paper that says you just got kicked out of the Army because you're gay. You're going to go back to that town mm-hmm. and try to find a job, because back then you had to show your discharge papers in order to apply for a job. That's, you know, walking in and saying, I'm gay, I want a job. So these guys got stuck there, and they had to figure out how to make a life with following what the Army just did, or the military just did to them. And so that's why these places, San Francisco and New York, became so and Los uh-huh. Angeles became so heavily populated with gay men, because after World War II, they were, you know, unloaded there and left to fend for themselves.
And once you've seen Gay Perry, it's hard to go back to the farm, right?
There's an actual song that goes, yeah. How do you gonna keep the boys on the farm after they've been to Gay Perry?
How you gonna keep them down on the farm after they've seen Perry? How you gonna keep them away from Broadway, jumping around and painting the town? How you gonna keep them away from harm? That's a mystery. They'll never want to see a rake or plow, and who the deuce can ballyhoo a cow? How you gonna keep them down on the farm after they've seen Perry?
Now, your book's great, but I've noticed that the guys are all wearing clothes. I mean, you must have come across some more scandalous photos.
Page 139, they're in swimsuits that look like women's swimsuits by today's standards.
The photos we have are of romantic couples. Mm-hmm. There's a ton of books out there of, you know, scanty dressed or not dressed
beefcake men, beefcake, or whatever, mm-hmm. ones or out there. Sexually explicit or stuff like that. The, There's no mystery. There are lots of books.
I mean, I'm feeling at page 141. That looks like right out of Bellamy.
Let me see that.
You know, that could have been filmed today.
What is Bellamy?
Google it.
European porn company.
A European adult film company that people reference on the internet. But, you know,
looks like Malta to me.
Or 164, you know, it's like, all you need to do is get yourself two skinny guys with, you know, an average good build, some cigarettes, some flip-flops, and a swimsuit that covers their belly button, and you can recreate these photos.
Well, the photograph on page 140 is actually two guys from France.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's two hunky guys in swimsuits. So, you know, that photo is for you to look at and go, okay, well, you know, are they just two friends standing there, or is it more? Mm-hmm. And you look at, you know, so he has his arm wrapped around mm-hmm. the one guy, but the thighs are touching. And if you go all the way down to the foot, his foot is slightly caressing the other one's foot. And
that's so why that's
another theme that's in through the book. And there's different photos through there of guys that have their foot placed a certain way over their partner or their lovers.
But yeah, let's play a game. Go to the very first picture in the book. Okay. And there's a tell in that picture that says this is absolutely 100% a couple.
Page 25.
Very first one.
Yeah, so on our is 26. Is of the men with the cigars. Yes. One's going down, right. The other one's going up. So we know which one's the top and the bottom, but you could see that the bottom is on top with his feet.
Well, keep going.
You haven't gotten it yet.
We had this photo for a couple of years, and when Hugh did a scan of it and blew it up, we were like, oh my gosh.
Holy cow.
I mean, we got it because the look in their eyes and the smirk of the one guy with the cigar going up, his face, and, you know, and they're holding hands and the legs crossed. But there's a true telltale on this photo.
I can't tell.
Let me give it in one.
Is it the leg? Is the foot over the other leg?
It's not the hands, it's not the feet, and it's not the cigars.
It's not
that his hand is in his crotch.
Yes. So we didn't even see that because his hand blended in with the pant leg, kind of, because it's a very small, it's maybe 2 inches by 4 inches. Yeah. It's a 10 type. And when you blew it up, we were like, oh my God, his hand's in his other guy's crotch.
Maybe he just said, is it time for lunch? I don't know. Why don't you reach in my pocket watch?
Looking for spare change or something.
Well, you know, in the kind of hats and clothing they're wearing, is there a certain tie to their nationality? Like, is the guy with the cigar going down Irish?
We don't know. We think it's an American photograph. We got it in the United States, but the clothing looks American. It looks like normal clothing for that time period, which would be 1880s, maybe earlier.
The one thing, you know, Tracy Chapman sang a song about her fast car.
Yes.
Getting her girlfriend out of that miserable little town, but they need to leave tonight or live and die this way. And the car, or the horse and buggy in this case, or bicycle, it seems to be a common thread in these couples' intimate photographs.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, like, you know, because Mark and I got into a discussion about this, it's like, you know, for example, a photograph on page 249, where it's like clearly the man being photographed is barking orders at the photographer with his hand over his eyes. Like, you know, David, make sure that I look good in this photo because I'm going to be sending this to my father. I'm going to be announcing to the world that I'm planning to marry this man.
I love it. You should write captions for all of our photos.
Oh, an interactive book. I like that idea.
It is. It does feel like the scene from Little Orphan Annie that Daddy Warbucks is, you know, he never really married a woman because
I don't
he
know.
Didn't
I
need to.
Okay, I didn't see the play or the film.
Oh my God, it's a New York City institution. Annie, especially because you guys are into this Depression era, FDR, black and white photos. Little Orphan Annie is a musical that takes place around this time period. And references a lot of interesting things, including optimism as a way of getting through the through difficult times. So certainly we find ourselves in today. So, you know, if you're feeling sad or frustrated or hopeless, listening to, you know,
that'll come out tomorrow.
Sarah Jessica Parker as a little girl singing Tomorrow.
Think of the children. Think of Annie.
The sun will come out tomorrow.
Saying Oliver, that's order from your commander-in-chief.
There'll be sun.
Eleanor?
I can't sing.
Sing.
Tomorrow, clears away the cobwebs and the sorrow. Till there's none.
So long for the president. When I'm stuck with a day that's gray and lonely, I just stick out my chin and grin and say, everybody, Republicans too, Oliver, sing.
The sun come out tomorrow, so you gotta hang on till tomorrow. Come what may,
harmony.
Tomorrow, tomorrow, I love you. Tomorrow, you're only a day away.
And just to be clear, that's not Sarah Jessica Parker. That is Eileen Quinn from the motion picture soundtrack.
And my favorite's with Carol Burnett. Oh my gosh.
As in the movie,
yes,
and Tim Curry plays Rooster.
Yeah.
Yes.
Easy Street. Easy Street.
Easy Street.
Annie is the key.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
A quick question for you. Did you know that Alyssa Milano was one of the first Annies?
I had no
from
idea.
Who's the Boss? Yes, that's before she got to Who's the Boss. That's how she got the job.
Wow. So she was a Broadway baby?
She was a Broadway baby.
We did see an excerpt from Annie. Have you ever heard of the musical called Forbidden Broadway?
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, yeah, it's a send up that they do every year as a fundraiser for different charities.
So the woman would come out dressed as Annie, and she'd have a cigarette in her hand, and she would sing, "I'm 30 years old tomorrow, and I haven't worked as I did, Annie." And then she'd take a drag off the cigarette. So I've seen that much.
For me, Andrea McArdle will always be Annie, who's, of course, she originated the role in the Broadway musical, and you can listen to the original soundtrack. But and Eileen Quinn played Annie in the film. It's really just, if you're a big fan of this type of genre and culture and time period, it is a wonderful musical that sort of captures, you know, a lot of children did live in orphanages, you know, in same gendered situations. And, you know, like in really a lot of ways, like people ask, like, is Bert and Ernie gay? And I'm like, well, they may not have been intentionally made to be gay characters, but they certainly were based on characters, Laurel and Hardy, that reference the Depression era and hard times where men were humiliated by having to share the same bed together and having to be intimate with each other, you know? And so like these photos sort of capture that as well, is they're like, hey, we have all this money. We can afford to have a photographer, and we're choosing to live with each other. Isn't that a lark?
Whatever you're funny, Peacock's got it exclusively. Bears beats The Office on Peacock. Stream every moment from Dunder Mifflin and explore bonus extras and exclusives. Plus, if you're looking for more classic hits, you can stream every episode of Parks and Recreation, 2 and a Half Men, and every season of SNL. In the mood for something brand new? Check out Peacock's original comedies, The Amber Ruffin Show, and Saved by the Bell. Whether you're craving a new binge or familiar fave, you can find tons of comedy hits on Peacock. Get started for free at PeacockTV.com. Whatever you're funny, Peacock's got it exclusively. Stream classic sitcoms like The Office, Parks and Recreation, and 2 and a Half Men. Plus, catch Peacock original comedies like AP Bio and Saved by the Bell. For all your exclusive comedy faves, go to PeacockTV.com and get started.
Well, you know, we do clarify in our essay that as early as 1902, you could take your own photograph, and we have in our book what we call the first selfie of a gay couple, loving couple. They are standing in front of a mirror. You can see the camera at the bottom of the image.
It's on page 297.
297. And the guy on the right is holding the little squeeze ball that will trip the shutter for the camera and take their photo. They wrote, it's not, you don't see this in the book because it was cut out by the designers. They wrote below their picture in the mirror.
And they also have a radio.
Do they?
No, look at the wrong photo. Oh, no, this is the other one. I see.
So yours is probably PDF 298.
Yeah. Okay, we see it now.
Oh, my goodness. That's amazing.
Selfie. It's a selfie.
It's a selfie using the mirror.
Mm-hmm. They're cute, too.
And, you know, for people who are still not convinced, at the very end of the book, you're like, it gets hot and heavy.
You know,
page 330, page 328.
Or
327, where the short guy is kissing the tall guy and standing on his tippy toes.
We know who that guy is. His name is Jack W. Chadbourne. This is him in high school with his high school boyfriend.
Oh,
he later fought. He was in the Navy during World War II, and he had a boyfriend in the Navy. We have about 8 or 9 pages from his photo album that show his high school boyfriend. There's about 5 or 6 photos of the two of them, and shows the other sailors that he served with, plus his boyfriend from. He was stationed somewhere in the Pacific Islands. You can't tell where though, but. His name is Jack W. Chadbourne. It's a wonderful photograph.
How did you acquire this one?
This one, oh boy.
I'm thinking it was when I was on the West Coast.
Maybe.
Because when I was traveling and I was going, if I was at work and I had a day free it was just cheaper to spend the weekend in a city, that I would find an antique store and start digging through things. And so we didn't keep track in the early days.
But I think you're right because... Yeah. He was born in Portland, Oregon, but he died in California.
Yeah,
and so that would account for you finding it somewhere on the West Coast. Yeah.
And how do you find out the information about who? Like, how do you know it was Jack, from an estate or from papers?
His name, it was written in somewhere on the album. I'm trying to remember where, but.
And so you did a.
Oh, it's on the back. That's right. There was a big group of sailors, friends. And he's in the photograph, and he names first and last name of each one, including himself. And so that's how we found out what his name was.
Wow. So in a lot of ways, you know, if you had a camera, that was like your little black book. It's a way of remembering all the guys you hooked up with.
Look at it that way.
If we get to do book 2, which will be men in military or men in uniform, we probably have one guy who I won't say his name yet, but he did have his little black book of photographies because he was very...
He was the belle of the ball.
Yeah, he was the belle of the ball. Cute, curly-headed
Smitty.
Guy.
His name is Smitty.
Okay, go ahead and tell his name. But Smitty took a lot of good pictures with a lot of different men.
One of the things, like a lot of these physique photographers, you know, were sort of the evolution of these type of photographs. And, you know, certainly like... What would the leather community be without Chuck Renslow and photography? Chuck Renslow was a friend of ours, a figure here in Chicago, who was obsessed with masculine, athletic, muscular men. And, you know, much like Tom of Finland, he would reach out to these guys and photograph them and make a lot of money by selling prints and magazines of them.
In the 50s and mail them out. He actually started photographing the members of the Chicago Ballet. And that's what he really started doing.
I think it was even the Joffrey, was it, in Chicago? But
they came later. But
so Chuck then started running bars, and every year he started doing a contest, which then evolved into the International Mr. Leather Contest, which popularized the idea of wearing, you know, motorcycle gang outfits as a sexual identity, as a fetish.
And this was during what time period?
Well, he started photographing, I believe, in the late 40s. And then into the 50s is when he started his magazine. And into the 60s, he had a huge legal battle with the U.S. mail. Because they're like, you can't send this through the mail. And he's just like, why not? And he's just like, well, because we said so. And he's like, well, that's not good enough. And so...
And what was really great is that Chuck, in his will, asked us... And about 15 other, Chicago people
to go to his bathhouse for a treasure hunt. And it was okay. A closed bathhouse, you know. So we're here and I'm like, there's got to be a pot of gold or some treasure chest. And it was, you know, like, have you ever heard of the Search of Lincoln's Gold? And they find that my gold is in the heart of every American.
I did find like five bottles of lube and like 10 bottles of poppers, but
they used all
the treasure hunt.
Already used those up. No, but you know, it was years ago. It was really fascinating, sort of, you know, going on a treasure hunt in an abandoned gay bathhouse that was one of the first bathhouses in the United States and a place where people like Bette Midler used to perform in. You know, here in Chicago. So
was there a treasure that was found?
The hearts of every boner. The treasure was in the joy and happiness that was experienced by the people that went there.
There was things like, you know, sex toys and those kinds of stuff where you could get a key to an old locker, those kinds of things.
Well, we know a friend who actually, like, for $25 bought a row of the lockers.
Yeah, I think it was the row with the number 69 on it.
You know, and to me, because I actually was a customer of the place back in my day, I still look at those lockers and go, ew, you have that in your house? You don't know what people, when I stuck in those lockers. One photo here before we wrap things up here that really Mark and I are very fascinated by is on page 321, which looks like a hoedown in some barn. Yeah. We're like, you know, and there's a lot of these similar photos where it's like, it's men dancing with each other. And you're kind of like, well, this is obviously like people who there's no women around and they're wanting to have a good time. But then page 321 on the bottom right hand corner is two men sucking the air out of each other's lungs.
Yeah.
Right.
That's a fascinating photograph. We don't know what to make of that. It's, you know, take it for what it is. They're all coupled except for one or
that
two
one
guys.
That one poor sad kid in the corner.
I know. He's pissed.
He's not happy at all. He's the two full-on lip lock. And it's an old photograph. That's probably from, could be the, do you think that's the late 1800s? Yeah, probably late 1800s, 1890s. And it looks like a, you know, like a gathering of gay men, gay couples,
and you know,
in a barn.
Yeah, well, or
with a fiddle.
They're gay bar.
No!
Instead of gay bar, it's a gay barn.
We're talking about two different photographs. Hold on.
No, there's many of
it
them.
It looks like they're in a barn,
but the one that we are showing here is in a barn, and you know, and you've
and
got,
it has writing at the bottom. Mm-hmm, writing mm-hmm, at the mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so this photograph has actually been published in another book about men, and we have there were several copies of it. Our copy is number 28.
Twenty-nine.
Cowboy dance stag, and then the next page is the men sucking the oxygen out of their. I'm worried that they might pass out. They're so
well, you know, they had to pose. Yeah, they had to pose that way for a good 15 seconds. That's why the two beside them look so surprised. I think that's why they look surprised. But because, you know, they had to, for the snap, they had to be still for several seconds.
How much would it cost to ruin a photo at that time period? Yeah, like you're like, you took a kiss in there in the picture and I can't take this home with me now. You know, it's like, you're like, that costs $12 or $200 or, you know, what, like.
Well, we know that the paper photos cost more than the tintypes. The tintypes came out in the 1860s, I think, it was very inexpensive because there wasn't a negative. The photograph was put onto a positive plate that had a coating on it. And so there, you know, it was just one.
It was like
it was handed to them within 15 minutes of it being produced. Paper photos cost back in that time were way more expensive. And this one is, was a cabinet card that has the photo laid on top of it.
It's quite large for its time, for the time period that it was taken. It's about,
so somebody had a lot of money that wanted this photo and they kept it.
To me, it's interesting because, you know, those guys, a lot of these, you know, poses are sort of acts of rebellion, you know, and I imagine that,
whoever took the photo or was organizing the photo would have been upset. You know,
we would call them acts of love, though.
By our standards, yeah. But at that time period, there may have been consequences for capturing something like that, you know?
Well, I think with this photo, they probably, it was a friend who took the photograph.
I see.
It's not very rebellious if you take the photograph and then you hide it from the world for its entire life.
Yeah, and back then, the guy who was a photographer probably was queer himself, probably developed the photo himself and gave it to them.
There's all sorts of scenarios where it's those are the likely cases that they're, you know, gay photographers, gay allies, and you know, just to clarify one thing in our essay and within our book, and when we talk about the subjects, we never refer to them as gay or homosexual. We only refer to them as couples who are in love with each other. We can extrapolate from that they're gay, possibly, but only John Moore, the soldier from the Rainbow Division, identified to his nephew that he was gay. We do like to draw a line just personally for ourselves. Sure. Anybody else is welcome to talk about the photographs any way they want to. But what we say is that we have pictures of two men who are in love with each other.
Because nobody wants to have an identity imposed upon them. Right.
Right.
But you can certainly describe what you see in it, right?
Well, we can describe, we don't have pictures of them being homosexual. That would be sexual in nature. Mm-hmm. We have pictures of them being in love. That's an emotional state.
What do you make of, like, you know, people who are like denying the intimacy between famous gay historical figures and their lovers? Like, you know, in interviews, Lin-Manuel Miranda is very adamant that Alexander Hamilton was not bisexual or in remotely interested in Lawrence at all.
Well, I think they have a very sad life if that's what they're going to put their focus on. And, you know, it's like there's several artists and painters and poets that are out there that they say, oh, well, they were bisexual because they may have had intimate relationship with a guy. If you look on page...
Oh, this is wonderful.
210, 211.
It's a double page.
Which is probably 211, 212 for you.
Yeah.
It's a double page
spread of two guys, and it's like they're laying in a hay field, and there's a blanket with a loaf of bread. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And
I love that one.
Okay. So you have it in front of you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Go. So we had an article done on us in the
Guardian,
and there was a professor from Vienna that reached out to the Guardian and said, can I get in contact or can you get me in contact with the authors of this book? I know who the two men are in the photograph. My question is, what year was it taken and who was the photographer? He says that the two men, the one, the guy on top, did you see the beautiful hair, is Rupert Brooke, who is a famous poet from the UK. The man underneath him that has the blanket kind of pulled over his head is Duncan Grant, who is a famous painter.
British, yeah, both. So these are two young men in love with each other. It's just a gorgeous photograph. The motion just jumps off the page. And these are two young men who are going to end up being very famous and are famous to this day. Rupert Brooke sadly died from a mosquito bite at the age of 28. So that places this photograph somewhere around 1910, 1915. And they're, you know, artists. One's a painter, one is a poet, and they're in love with each other, and they're on the precipice of being famous and known around the world for the rest of their lives and beyond to this day. Mm-hmm. And their photograph ends up in this book, and we didn't even know it was them when we chose it.
Wow. That's what's so interesting, is that we stand on the shoulders of so many people whose names we have no idea who they are.
Exactly. Yeah. These guys, they couldn't narrate their own lives until now. Now they're able to say, this is who we are. This is who we were.
Do you believe in ghosts, or like they're speaking to you in their dreams and saying thank you?
I think that we get the thank you from the people, and maybe they're speaking through the people who have bought the book, or that it's changed their life, or that the just a multitude of notes through Facebook and Instagram and letters written to us, that just being so appreciative that we're sharing these photographs of love that help to mend maybe
the relationship in a family, or give a mother the hope that her child is going to have a loving relationship, because what they may have only seen, whether it's movies or reading a newspaper or from, you know, what the religious right pushes out there, that there's no hope for their kid to have a wonderful life. They see these photos and they say, well, that's not right. There is love that I see in these photographs all the way back to the 1850s, and I know my child's going to be okay. And they can build that relationship by, you know, sharing this.
And I do fantasize a little bit that these men are in heaven looking down and going, holy cow, these two guys from Texas collected all these photographs, and one of them was ours, and they made it into a book, and the book is all over the world, and everybody's in love with these photographs. They couldn't have imagined a day like this.
You don't know gay people like I do. They'd be like mad that you're using their photo. You keep my name out of your mouth. No, I'm just kidding. But
no, it's a beautiful sentiment, especially with Valentine's Day coming up. It's you have me all teary-eyed looking at these photos.
Oh, thanks. Well, Neil and I have not been able to experience these photos all at once, like people, you know, getting the book now. These photos came to us over a 20-year period, you know, one at a time, two at a time, and something like that. And so we had our moments for sure. But when the book launched, we had our advanced copies for a month. Neither one of us talked about it. We didn't open it up. We didn't look at it. We had no idea if it would have a voice, and if it did have a voice, if people would hear it, and if they heard it, if, you know, what effect would it have on them? Well, the jury's in. We've heard from people from literally all over the world, and they've shared some really wonderful stories with us, and it's confirmed that the message of our collection, which is love, and that the subjects are male, is secondary. Mm-hmm. The message is love, and people are receiving the message, and it's touching them, and it's changing their lives in some small way, and sometimes in some larger way. And we just feel grateful beyond words that these people are sharing this with us, and it's because of this book and these men that came before all of us.
It seemingly feels like this would be a fantastic Museum of Photography exhibition as well.
We've been approached by MoMA, and
we'll just say that's our hope, is that the collection will be represented in a museum, so that everyone can actually see the real photos, see what someone's holding in their, you know, what the men that are in these photos held in their hand at that time, and see the true photograph. Yeah. And
it is our dream that the collection ends up in a museum where people can go see it firsthand. Mm.
Have you guys ever attempted to photograph yourselves and go into like a, you know, those tourist saloons,
the old timey,
at Niagara Falls in a barrel or something?
I had never thought about it until the other day on Instagram. Someone started following us, and when I went to their page, and they're from Switzerland, so we have to go all the way to Switzerland to do it. Yeah. He has a tintype camera, he takes photographs of people with the tintype with the same process used, you know, over 100 years ago. And, you know, that to me would be impressive. I would love to have a photograph done on a tintype that way. And, you know, dress similar to what, I mean, a lot of these photos look very modern. I mean, the hairstyles, I wish I had hair so I could fix my hair that way. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, next year is going to be your 40th wedding anniversary. Is that right?
No, 30.
30. Sorry, I'm doing my math wrong.
That's all right.
What have you guys grown to accept about yourselves, and what have you, how have you changed as people in those 30 years in your marriage?
Well, I think one, it's been a fast change in this last year. I mean, our love is stronger or anything else, but, you know, when you both work really hard and you're working all the time and you don't spend that much time together, that was a lot of our life. Then we moved to New York and we spent more time together. We've spent 24/7 for the last COVID year together, and working, seeing that we have been able to do a project and work together. And it just solidifies that, our relationship was meant to be, because we've been able to work together. I never would have thought we'd be able to work together over the years. I don't know, but and live together and stay together and not fight, and just and the love is stronger.
And, you know, before our relationship started, I wondered, you know, if I was lucky enough to be in a relationship for a long time, do you just get to a point where you just sort of coexist and why change anything now? It's worked this much, this well up until now. Let's just keep going or something like that. And what I found is that as much as we loved each other so much in the very beginning, the love has grown over the years and continues to grow. That surprises me because of Neil. I mean, he's not the easiest one to love.
I try.
Wait. Neil's not the dance teacher. Neil's not the stern taskmaster.
No, that's me. No, I'm serious. It really is. You have so much invested in this person and in this time that you've spent together, and the love grows stronger. And I didn't think I could be any more in love with Neil than I was when we first met. But I am.
Oh,
you know, it's wonderful to be talking to you guys on the 16th anniversary of the Feast of Fun podcast. My husband and I started this 16 years ago to the date,
February 8th. Anniversary.
Thank you.
I got him a knife and fork because that is the traditional wedding gift for 16 years.
Is it?
Cutlery.
A cutlery. Okay.
They have another term for that. It's one of those British words for basically, you know, silverware.
Okay.
And yes. I'm like, oh, so you've been surviving for 16 years without good forks and spoons?
Well, the help stole it all.
But so for me, it's like, you know, it's such an honor and such a delight to talk to other couples, especially same-sex couples, who collaborate together on creating a project, you know. And for us, sometimes we, unfortunately or fortunately, we don't have biological children, you know. We tend not to. And so I always tell people, you know, you need a project. You need to put something, your hearts into something that can bond you together. And I would say, like, for Mark and I, doing the podcast has been this act of love between each other and negotiating power and energy and passion, and also putting something out there that will outlive us and make the world, leave the world a better place than we found it. And I think you guys have found that in this book.
Unexpected. For sure. I mean, we did not see this coming.
Are children ever expected?
No, not for lack of trying, though.
We had a few redheads over the year, but...
No, we have actually
Irish
a lot of
setters.
Yeah, our dogs. Because of my teaching, I'm called a ballet dad, and so Neil was the other ballet dad, and by a lot of... You know, a lot of students that I have very close relationships to this day with, who are in their 40s and 50s, but some are younger. And when you're a ballet teacher, you don't teach a student and then next year you teach a different student. You teach a student for as long as 8 to 10 years. So that's a very long time to spend together. It's you develop strong bonds, and those don't go away once the ballet is over. So we have children by extension of my career, and they think of us as surrogate parents, literally, in many instances, literally.
And that's what's so great, is that they now get to do that for other people, and that love continues.
Yes.
If you can have anything about Valentine's Day for people who are single right now out there, is just like, you know, love is something you can give to somebody.
Yes, it is. And the book is a testament to hope for love. If these guys could do it, if they were able to do it under those circumstances that they surrounded them, and the photos would survive as long as 170 years to make it into this book. I think this book, these photographs have been through world wars, pandemics, the Great Depression, on and on and on, and you name it, and they survived, and they're still here. I mean, the book is an example of the photographs. We have the actual photographs. They made it.
Yeah. I mean, we're going through a pandemic. You guys are familiar with the Spanish flu.
Yes.
And, you know, the musical Chicago, right, took place right after the Spanish flu. People just gave up and they're like, you know what? We just got to do some heroin and drink and gamble and shoot each other.
Are you literal about that? Are you saying that literally?
I'm deadly serious. Yeah. The musical Chicago takes place in the years
in the 20s,
in the 1920s.
And they say part of the reason why it was the Roaring Twenties is because people were just, you know, they had the Spanish flu. A lot of people died. And then they just was like, listen, let's party. You
know? Okay. Got it.
So just remember, you know, 5 years from now, you're going to be singing, you can like the life you're living. You can live the life you like. You can marry Harry, but mess around with Ike. So get your fishnets and your dancing shoes on. Because we're going to have some fun when this pandemic ends. I hope to see you guys in person. Hugh, Ninny, Neil Treadwell, it was such a delight chatting with you guys.
A real pleasure.
Thank you very much. It's Hugh Nini.
Hugh Nini.
Yes.
Hugh Nini. Yeah.
Like Houdini, but
like Houdini. Like Houdini.
Oh. Yes. Did I pronounce it like not Nini or how did I'm so sorry?
Nini.
You pronounce it N-I-N-N-Y.
Nini. Okay, so we just
Nini.
Got a quick buddy.
Oh, Hugh Nini.
Everyone in the US pronounces my name correct. Pronounces his name wrong. Anyone in Europe, they all screw up my name and they pronounce his name right. So we laugh every time we go through it.
Well, Neil, how do the Europeans say your name?
Treadwell. Neil Treadwell and Houdini.
You've got to put a Texas twist to it.
It's Nuni.
Nuni.
We have heard our names pronounced in German, French, Italian, and Portuguese and
Spanish.
Oh my God, it's the craziest thing.
Hug Nini Nel Treadwell.
Treadwell.
That's very Russian of you.
Well, it's a pleasure chatting with you guys. I hope to see you guys in person when the pandemic ends in New York City. You guys are really been a blast, and I adore the book and I adore you guys. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule, because I imagine everything takes three times longer to do, right?
Now with the pandemic, right?
Yeah, exactly.
We're all treading water.
We're treading water and we're adapting, and that's what we do. Yeah. But thank you very much for inviting us. We very much appreciate it. It's been
a lot of fun.
It's been a lot of fun.
A feast of fun.
Yes. Just to shoot the shit with, and happy 16th anniversary.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you guys. Well, take care.
Y'all take care.
You too.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Hugh Nini and Neil Treadwell live in New York City. Their book, Loving.
Loving. That's a longer title. Loving, a photographic history of men and love, 1850s to 1950s.
Yeah,
100 years of men and love.
The look of love is in your eyes. No, the book of love is on for sale. You can click on the links and buy. You really want to get it for February 14th. That is Valentine's Day. Why don't you give it a try? Or not. You can get it. Of course you want
to
get it.
No one's is free to escape from Cupid's bow and arrow and is going to shoot you and make you fall in love with someone.
Yeah. You know, that's the thing. It's like, it's amazing that you and I have come together and that we found each other in this wild, crazy world. And, you know, for people who are not in relationships or who are happily single,
60% of gay men are single.
Yeah. It's fantastic that you can put energy into yourself. You can be in a relationship of one.
Yeah, and a lot of people are trading like romantic relationships for friendship, and because Valentine's Day is around now, girls have like Galentine's Day, and maybe guys can have their Guyentine's
Brolentine's Day.
Brolentine's Day.
Sounds terrible.
But, you know, for Valentine's Day, my mother always gave us little gifts. I think she got them on sale after Christmas or something like that, or little cards. And so it was always sweet. So for me, like, Valentine's Day has been a romantic thing, but it's also just been a time to celebrate just love in general.
There are many ways to say I love you.
That's right.
And it's never a bad time to send a message to somebody you care about that you are glad that they're in your lives. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes I get my friends weirded out by that.
Yeah.
They're like, I love you. I think of you as family. And they're like, I'm not going to lend you any money.
But that is one of the best ways to say I love you and I love what you do is to become a Plus subscriber at Feast of Fun. And you can do that at feastoffun.com/plus or make a donation at feastoffun.com/donate, Venmo,
PayPal, Cash App.
Cash App at Feast of Fun or mail at Feast of Fun.
You can even send us Bitcoin through the Cash App.
Oh, wow.
That's right, honey. And so for every dollar, if we hold on to it, then it blossoms if it grows or tanks.
We'll
but
see.
We do accept Bitcoin, so you can, like, you know, tail the
gold. Some people have some extra Bitcoin, and they're just like, I'm not going to buy illegal drugs with this anymore. I'm not doing that anymore. Let me send the Bitcoin to Fausto.
Yeah, use it to make the world a better place. Yeah. You know, every single dollar you support goes to support the podcast, goes into creating this in-depth, one-of-a-kind programming. If Feast of Fun doesn't do it, who will?
Yeah.
You know, it really is amazing to be able to talk to Hugh and Neil about this book. And it's a fantastic book. Definitely, if you are subscribed to us on the Apple Podcasts podcast directory, you can download a version of this show that has the images that we're talking about. And for our premium subscribers as well, we're going to put together a rich version of the podcast where the album art changes dynamically. Hopefully we can get this to work as you we'll listen see. To it. So, but definitely it is something. We are also on Spreaker, so you can subscribe there and you can see the album art changing as you play it as well. That's something that's supported there. So definitely check it out. Apple Podcasts, hit subscribe, smash that subscribe button, honey. Share the show with your friends. Let us know what you think. We accept positive and negative feedback. We love to hear from you guys. Write to us on social media at Feast of Fun, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. We are everywhere.
We're there.
Darling, yes. Let us know. Happy anniversary, Mark.
Happy anniversary to you.
I love you so much.
I love you too. What a great way to spend our anniversary is talking about loving.
Talking my favorite topic, love.
Goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
Whatever you're funny, Peacock's got it exclusively. Bears beats The Office on Peacock. Stream every moment from Dunder Mifflin and explore bonus extras and exclusives. Plus, if you're looking for more classic hits, you can stream every episode of Parks and Recreation, 2 and a Half Men, and every season of SNL. In the mood for something brand new? Check out Peacock's original comedies, The Amber Ruffin Show, and Saved by the Bell. Whether you're craving a new binge or familiar fave, you can find tons of comedy hits on Peacock. Get started for free at peacocktv.com. Whatever you're funny, Peacock's got it exclusively. Stream classic sitcoms like The Office, Parks and Recreation, and 2 and a Half Men. Plus, catch Peacock original comedies like AP Bio and Saved by the Bell. For all your exclusive comedy faves, go to peacocktv.com and get started.